Well, hey, Sean. Hey there, Laurel.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
So, how's it going?
Well, I mean, I feel like you kind of know where we're at today, emotionally.
Yeah. It's not good, John.
Yeah? Why? What's getting to you?
Okay, let's review. We are waiting for a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that could totally upend Wisconsin's stay-at-home order. And also, importantly, force us to record another podcast, meaning that we are right now probably recording something that will never see the light of day and wasting our time.
Yeah, it's sort of like we're pointless, just floating through the ether today with no real purpose or role or, you know, job until this thing happens. And, you know, like, what is life? Why? Why, John? Why?
Wow. That is, that's bleak.
It's dark, isn't it?
It really is. But you know what helps with existential malaise and kills time while waiting for a major court decision to potentially drop?
What? I don't know, but I suppose you're going to tell us.
Yes, I am. Podcasting.
Okay, so you're telling us that in order to reduce the stress and the angst of having to re-record the podcast later today, we will record this podcast, even though we will have to delete it later.
Yep, that's pretty much what I'm saying.
Okay, works for me. Fine, sure.
Whatever.
Great. This is the WPR Politics Podcast. I'm John K. Wilson.
I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Laurel White.
This week, waiting to podcast by podcasting.
It's ridiculous.
And that intro music, of course, is The Waiting from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' 1981 album, Hard Promises. I mean, I think you can probably clearly see that he was writing about waiting for a legal decision when he came up with the lyrics to that song.
I mean, obviously.
I feel like it is difficult. It is difficult. Every phone notification, it's like, oh, is that you, Supreme Court? No, it's something else. Like all week, every notification.
And in 1981, when he wrote that song, he was getting these phone notifications about a court case that he was following.
Oh, you know, man.
Some artists are just ahead of their time, and he could see and feel that experience from that distance.
And he was probably sitting by a rotary phone waiting for it to ring with the news of a Supreme Court decision, obviously.
Obviously.
For the record, I just want to clear up that I was pulling for J-Lo's Waiting for Tonight to be used for our intro music, but I was overruled in a 2-1 decision by my podcast colleagues here.
John's dissent was quite moving, though. You know, to hear John talk about J-Lo, you do not want to get him started. He loves her so much. It's like a little uncomfortable.
Well, maybe someday we'll revisit the case and overturn precedent.
Good. Oh man, we're just having a little nerd festival here, guys. This is great.
Yeah, it's what we do.
So, speaking of court things and waiting, what court things are we waiting on, guys?
Only one of the most important state Supreme Court decisions of our lifetime, man. The state Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in the challenge to Wisconsin's safer at home order. And what they rule is going to decide how we as a state address COVID-19 in the weeks and months and potentially years to come. So that's what we're waiting on, is a decision in that case, which was argued on Tuesday and has not yet been decided.
As of recording this podcast, which if you're listening to this podcast, you know, it still hasn't been decided. And if you're not listening to this podcast, then you're not listening to this podcast, and you're listening to a different one where a decision has come down.
I feel like we should release this just like as an Easter egg and be like, this is the podcast. This is the phantom podcast that we recorded that no one was ever going to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe
like
after
a deep cut.
We're like, they'll release it after we're gone. We'll be like true fans of the WPR Politics podcast. We'll like to listen to this material never released
from the archive,
the deluxe album, collector's edition.
It's like those songs released that Prince never wanted anyone to hear, but then they started releasing them after he died. It'll be just like that.
Yeah,
except
exactly.
We
have a similar following. We have a similar following to Prince, obviously. So,
I would say we are the Prince of public radio politics podcasts.
See, I feel like we're just letting this one get away because we're so confident that it's not going to release, that we're just like, we'll just talk about whatever. So
to get this thing back on the rails, as it were, you mentioned the news this week, sort of. I mean, we've been talking about this court decision in past podcasts, but the news is that we heard oral arguments in the case this week. So what was the deal there? What was that like?
Well, this was... Laurel has covered a virtual session of the state Supreme Court before. I have not until this week. So you got to see the state Supreme Court meet virtually. They had a Zoom call to hold oral arguments, which is really something. And it was Rebecca Bradley who really made a lot of the news from this week's arguments, because she just really attacked the stay-at-home order in no uncertain terms. I mean, you know, sometimes you listen to Supreme Court arguments and judges or justices in Supreme Court's case will ask really tough questions of the attorneys, or they'll be very critical of an argument, and that's their job, right? So like you're cautioned, don't read too much into oral arguments, because that is their job to do this, to play devil's advocate and everything. But I mean, find me one person who thinks that Justice Rebecca Bradley was just playing devil's advocate here. She was extremely critical of the stay-at-home order. She said so. She had a problem with, you know, the executive branch having that much power to, as she viewed it, make law. And she compared it to tyranny. You know, in her opening questions for the Department of Justice attorney who is defending the order and defending the Evers administration, she cut him off 20 seconds in and compared what was happening now with the DHS secretary taking these unilateral steps to tyranny. So that's where she's at on this. And that's what got a lot of attention. You saw a lot of national media outlets watching our court for this case because of the importance. And that's what grabbed them. And I think their thought was that she reflects the views of the conservative court. I'm not sure about that. We'll see about that. She's certainly the most outspoken justice that we have on either side of the spectrum at this moment.
So stepping back a little bit, aside from Bradley's reaction, which seems, you know, pretty notable, what were the sort of arguments coming from each side here, from the lawyers representing Republican lawmakers and the Evers administration? What was the back and forth like? Or I guess not back and forth, because they each stand up and are able to make their case. But what were the cases that they made?
The attorney for Republican lawmakers basically came out and said this is not about the coronavirus response. They're trying to frame it as a more limited case about who he has a seat at the table when it comes to deciding these things, and that the legislature needs to be involved when it comes to, you know, the Department of Health Services powers to address the coronavirus or other communicable diseases. You know, the DHS, there's a set of laws. It's Chapter 252. As everybody knows now, because
of course,
you know, we all know it's Chapter 252, that spells out very broad powers for the DHS secretary in really no uncertain terms that she can do these things. The legislature's case is, yes, she can, but she needs to promulgate them as rules, which go to a legislative committee, which in practice gives Republican lawmakers veto authority over what the DHS does in these cases.
So I feel like part of the debate about this is kind of the structure of the administrative rule process in Wisconsin and the manner in which the executive branch needs or believes it needs to respond to crises like this. So isn't kind of part of the argument from the Evers administration that it needs to be able to move quickly, it needs to be able to sort of do things, not necessarily, you know, saying they need to do them unilaterally, but just not have extra kind of checks that are built into the administrative rule process because this is such a fast-moving thing and actions need to be taken quickly. And so if it starts going through that rulemaking process versus, you know, the administration just being able to issue orders, DHS just being able to issue orders like they're doing right now, the state wouldn't be able to be as effective in fighting COVID-19 or whatever the next, you know, if another outbreak like this happens or some other communicable disease problem, that it would be less effective. That's kind of where they're coming from, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, a matter of timing. They feel like that the administrative process is sort of like deliberately cumbersome. You know, that the legislature has, during the time that Republicans have been in control especially, put a lot of checks on state agencies when it comes to administrative rules. Gives the legislature more say over how agencies operate. But it slows things down. And so the Evers administration is saying, if you attach the state's response to communicable diseases to this administrative rulemaking process, you're going to slow that down. And they say that, like, for example, when COVID-19 was starting to spread, based on the models they were looking at, and I know those have been under a lot of scrutiny lately because they varied widely and some were better than others, right? But they're saying that the best information they had was that the state needed to act immediately. And within a matter of days, in order to really stop an outbreak of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. And so they're saying that because they were able to act quickly to shut the state down, that saved hundreds, if not thousands, of lives, was what they talked about in their legal brief. The other thing they talk about in their legal brief is that, you know, these powers, the legislature gave the DHS secretary these powers. They exist in state law because a previous legislature, not the people that are serving the legislature now, but the legislative branch, gave the executive branch these powers because someday something like this might happen. So that's where they're coming from.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's interesting about this that the speaker brought up in an event that I covered later this week after the arguments happened was he said that he thinks it's fine for the executive branch to have more sort of unilateral control for a finite amount of time at the beginning of a crisis. He said those 60 days, that's okay. We acknowledge that sort of window needing to exist, but we think after a certain point, the legislature needs to be involved because in his view, he thinks the legislature is more in touch with Wisconsin residents, with business owners, they're having more contact with constituents. And so them having a seat at the table in sort of this crafting process of a new stay-at-home order or, you know, orders as they're initiated is a better democratic process, I guess would be the best way to say it.
Yeah, it is noteworthy that they are not challenging the governor's emergency powers in this case. You know, these orders were issued by DHS Secretary Andrea Palm. They're at the direction of the governor, okay? She is unelected, but she serves at the, you know, discretion of the governor and under his direction. So, you know, she's not just off there doing these on her own. But the legislature is not going after a separate set of powers that Governor Tony Evers has that lasts 60 days, as you referenced. And those powers can be taken away from the governor at any point by passing a joint resolution where both houses of the legislature could pass this joint resolution. It does not need a governor's signature, and his powers go away. The powers that they're challenging here are a different set. They are laid out in a different law, Chapter 252, of course, and that's what's before the Supreme Court in this particular challenge.
But this, sorry, I'm just fixated on this. The administrative rule process that they want Andrea Palm to use would be different because, right, basically what she's doing right now is just issuing orders and rules without that, right? And the reason she can do that is because of the emergency order that the governor has, the emergency powers. He gave her that ability, right? So aren't they kind of tied together?
Well, that I mean, I think that's the Republican view of things, is that they're tied together. Mm-hmm. And that the Evers administration's view of things is that they're not. That her powers
exist. Because they're written into law.
Independent. They exist independent from the governor's powers. And you don't need a governor's declaration to unlock the secretary's powers, that they always existed. You didn't know about them, but that the secretary, we didn't know about them. Mm-hmm. But the secretary has always had these powers. They've just never been needed before.
Under Chapter 252.
Anytime there's like, anytime there's a big communicable disease emergency, she could use those powers regardless of what the governor does.
So this has come up though in arguments is like, okay, what is a big enough communicable disease for these powers to be unlocked? Justice, or again, Rebecca Bradley said, what about the seasonal flu? Every year, the seasonal flu kills tens of thousands of people. That's a communicable disease. Is that enough for you to decide to use DHS's powers? And the state's response to that was no, and you know, public health experts would not equate the two. But that's definitely a question that's being asked as this is debated in front of the court.
So you mentioned a couple of things that Justice Rebecca Bradley said in her comments from the virtual bench. Were there other things from other justices in the questions that they asked that gave any sort of hint about where things might be going? I mean, I know it's very perilous to be trying to read the tea leaves about this stuff based on justices' reactions. Mm-hmm. But as you watched the arguments going on, was there anything else that really sort of stood out to you?
Let's start with sort of the other comment that grabbed headlines, but doesn't necessarily say where the court's at on this, I think. Mm-hmm. And that is when Justice Patience Rogensack was talking about the outbreak of COVID-19 cases in Brown County. The state's lawyer, the DOJ lawyer, was saying, you can have outbreaks anytime. Look what's happening in Brown County. And she talked about that. Oh, that was in the meatpacking plants, though. That wasn't among regular folks. That got a lot of attention because, people who were critical of that said, like, you're insinuating people that work in meatpacking plants are not regular folks, right? Who are the regular folks? I think her supporters have said, you know, she was referring to essentially just differentiating people who work in meatpacking plants and those who don't. I would say some comments that got no attention really, and you know, why would they, given everything else that was in this hearing? But Brian Hagedorn, one of the conservatives, was asking kind of really specific questions. Like as soon as arguments got started, he just had a bunch of questions about when does an order go from being a general order, one that, you know, in the legislature's argument needs the legislature's stamp of approval, and when can the DHS act unilaterally to address, you know, localized health issues. He said, like, what, you know, so he starts kind of running through this geographic list of when DHS might be able to act. What about, like, everybody, I forget if he said north or south of I-29, you know, well, what about if it was just for one county? And it was like when he got to that one county, what, like, could the state act to shut things down in one county? the attorney's legislature said, yeah, basically, that's right. You could do that. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
Well, that's kind of an interesting admission from the attorney for the legislature saying that the DHS could shut down individual counties right now without necessarily the legislature stepping in and saying it's okay. I hadn't heard that before from the legislature.
So theoretically, that means that there could just be 72 orders from the DHS secretary all saying the same thing,
yeah,
county by county.
Again, this came up too, because where do you draw the line? If you can do it for one county, why couldn't you do it for 72? The attorney for the legislature said, no, you know, not really. But where do you draw that line? If it's okay to do it a little bit, but not a lot, where is the line? And I kind of feel like the mm-hmm. Supreme Court might decide where that line is, and that the fact that they didn't issue the decision immediately tells you that it's not just a clean up or down vote on this court, and that they're going to be doing a lot of deciding about what the state can do in these cases.
I think kind of teasing out the regional distinction there is really interesting, because we know that that's something that Republican lawmakers are really interested in, right? Sort of taking this more county by county, community by community approach that's different than what the governor and the administration has done so far. Is there overlap there between that conversation that Republican lawmakers have had and sort of that line of questioning, you think?
So we don't know what the Republican plan is exactly, because they have kind of deliberately not offered one. And even if they mm-hmm. win this case, it's going to be the governor and his administration, really, that have to come up with the plan that the legislature says yay or nay to. I think what it tells me, I don't know if the court's going to agree with this assertion that DHS could do this, but if the court did that, it would mean that the state would retain some power over managing individual county outbreaks without ever needing to even reach a deal with the legislature. They could get what they want, and the state could get some of what it wants without ever actually reaching a deal, mm-hmm. which I hadn't really pondered as possible before. I thought maybe if they didn't reach a deal, local county health officers would be the ones who would be deciding this stuff on a county by county basis. But this sort of the argument sort of raises the prospect that, yeah, the state could still be involved, but just in a different way than it is right now.
So sort of looking ahead, Laurel, you mentioned that you covered an event with Speaker Robin Voss this week, and I feel like we got a little bit more of an answer about what Republicans would be looking to do if things go their way and the Evers administration's order is struck down. We got at least a little bit more clarity there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think so. They'd been talking about this regional distinction for a while, so that really wasn't new, and he talked about that. A couple things that sort of stood out to me as new, and maybe Sean can correct me if they've been out there for a while, but I thought Voss saying that he doesn't really like the idea of an essential business list was kind of interesting. He said that the government shouldn't be saying which businesses are allowed to be open while others have to be closed. He used a specific example of, you know, going to Walmart to get a key made and to buy flowers. And he said, if you can do that, why can't you go to the key shop and the flower store? What's the difference there? And then the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting is he talked about specifically setting up a system for opening back up restaurants in phases and being very specific about the different kind of benchmarks for restaurants, sort of like this is when you can have patio seating, this is when you can have 25% capacity inside, this is when you can have 50% capacity inside, just providing more structure there and sort of I guess structure is the right word, yeah, from the state for business owners. And then he also mentioned just kind of quickly, he said he wanted there to be more guidance about when churches can have in-person worship again, when religious services can start happening again across Wisconsin, that's a priority for Republicans based on what they've heard from constituents.
So if Republican lawmakers were to prevail in the Supreme Court's decision, Do you feel like the stuff that Voss was talking about this week is sort of setting down markers about what lawmakers would want to see from a new plan from Evers if lawmakers were to be giving it a thumbs up vote, if it goes through the rulemaking process and lawmakers then have that veto power?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's him saying the sort of things he would like to see is definitely an indicator of, you know, what they're bringing to that conversation, and they obviously want to be part of the conversation. So you never know how actual negotiations are going to go or how things might change over time, but I think those are signs of how things might tilt. I think it's interesting to note, too, though, that in this case, didn't the legislature ask for a very specific amount of time to sort of work with the governor's administration about crafting a new stay-at-home order if the current one is struck down? Didn't they say something like six days?
They did. And so Here's where I'm thinking that we're going to get this really, really complicated decision from them. I don't think it's a clean up or down from them, because I feel like we would have had it by now, you know?
Yeah.
And the legislature asked, you're right, for a 6-day stay that would keep the current stay-at-home order in place while the governor promulgates a rule, you know, the DHS promulgates a rule for a replacement order. But during court, the attorney for the legislature was asked about how long it would take to craft that rule given the current circumstances. He said, well, you know, because they haven't started it yet, it would really be, now it'd be 12 days. So now it's a few days after that. I don't know what the new number is for how long it would take to craft this rule. The governor's office says it'd be more like 20 days. And it is like May 8th as we're recording this. The Safer at Home order is scheduled to expire on May 26th. So every day that the court kind of delays here, it kind of raises the question about what this ruling, what bearing is this ruling going to have on the current stay-at-home order? I don't know. I mean, Tony Evers is out today. His administration's out with kind of guidelines for what businesses should do when they reopen. So he's inching that direction a little bit right now. Certainly not as quickly as the business lobby and, you know, many business owners want.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, there's this push to change things and to have kind of a different system in place for the state rules and guidelines. But we are kind of every day moving closer, in theory, to the governor's administration itself issuing changed guidelines, because he has these criteria set up for the Badger Bounce Back Plan, which is his, you know, plan for entering different phases of what life looks like with different, you know, testing goals and PPE goals and contact tracing and things like that. And we're getting closer. I mean, there have been the past few days, there have been good indicators that might mean we could be, in theory, moving toward phase one of that plan, which institutes some changes. So it's sort of funny because, you know, the rule, the order that legislature is pushing back on right now and wants to be changed might not exist in the same capacity by the time the court comes out with something. And maybe that's just a reiteration of what you were just saying, but it's just, things are changing so much, I guess is my point.
Yeah. We should mention though, that what they are talking about doing would change the process for future stay at home orders. And we've never been through a global pandemic like this one before, so we don't know what this one's going to look like. But if it's anything like, say, the 1918 flu, it'll come back again somewhere, you know, that it'll come in waves. If we go out and start interacting in the public again more, there's a chance that we bring the case numbers up. There's a chance that the state would need to issue something like this again. And so what's going to happen in that case will be determined in large part by this state Supreme Court decision and what it means for the interplay between the governor's office and the legislature.
Before we wrap up here, we should mention probably also that this is not the only case about the stay-at-home order that is out in the world now, too. I think we mentioned it very briefly last week in a future John update segment, but now that we are in the present future, do you want to talk a little bit more about what that that new case is?
So that case is brought by individuals who say that their constitutional rights to free speech, free exercise of religion, constitutional rights, individual rights have been violated. And that may end up, I don't know, that may end up being pretty consequential to this case, potentially. You did hear on a couple occasions during arguments. So this is something I didn't quite grasp when reading the briefs on my own, but was made abundantly clear during arguments, is that the case brought by the legislature against the governor is not a constitutional claim. It is a statutory claim. So like they're arguing over a law, not over the Constitution. Whereas this individual case is a constitutional claim. And so if justices like Rebecca Bradley are concerned with constitutional rights being, you know, in her view, trampled, the attorney for the DOJ was saying, you got this other case coming right now. It's going to be in your courtroom. That would be the place to address this stuff. So why does that matter? Well, for one, it slows things down for two, whatever. the other case, so the law is like severable, meaning that the court could strike down parts of it that it views as unconstitutional in that individual case, but leave the rest of it. But in the case brought by Republicans, they would have to strike down the whole thing. That's what that lawsuit is going after, is to strike down the whole thing. That's my read of it anyway. Maybe I'm wrong in the severability. Maybe I'm wrong in severability, but when the DOJ attorney is sort of begging the court, hey, wait for this other case to come before you, that tells you that they're definitely different animals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess if you are still listening to this podcast and listening to it at all because it made it out in the world, that means that the Supreme Court hasn't decided on this case, and so there's still a lot more to come, so we will be here to talk about that stuff when it does happen.
Alternatively, as Laurel mentioned, you are listening to this on a greatest hits album of the WPR Politics podcast, maybe 80 years in the future.
Long after we're gone.
In which case, we salute you. And, obviously, we had a good run there, didn't we?
Do you guys have hoverboards yet? Let us know. Somehow. Okay, bye.
Well, Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief.
Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Reporter.
And John K. Wilson is our resident politics nerd.
Whatever it is that you're waiting on, you can kill a little bit of time almost every single week when you subscribe to get new episodes of the WPR Politics Podcast. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast apps. While you're there, leave a rating or review of the show to help other people find it. And of course, you don't have to wait to catch up on all of our past episodes. They're available anytime at wpr.org/politics.